listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we speak with Margaret Kimberly, who's a columnist with BlackAgendaReport.com, with a weekly column entitled Freedom Rider. Her column last week was entitled Contradictions of White Supremacy, and it begins with a discussion of the profiling in the New York Times of an Ohio Nazi. Kimberly discussed the kid glove approach taken by the Times, which was characterized as too obvious, and discusses the reaction of readers and what it means in the larger context of white supremacy in the United States. We spoke with her via Skype Thursday. Let's talk about white supremacy, which means let's talk about something going on in America and the contradictions, which they don't get talked about much.
No, they don't. I was moved to write this article because of a brouhaha in the New York Times. A reporter interviewed a man who is a overt proclaimed white supremacist in Ohio. A man with who can be called a Nazi. He has Nazi memorabilia and so forth. And they gave him the floor, basically, in this interview. No pushback, no nothing. And readers were outraged about this, and I believe that they should have been, but it raised a couple of issues for me. One, this was not the first puff piece about a white supremacist in American media. Richard Spencer, when he was first introduced to the public, it was like he was a new celebrity. Yeah. People talked about his good looks and all kinds of things. It was quite telling to me. And the fact that people are fascinated by them, I don't think there's that much to say. There are a lot of people who are racist. We live in a very racist country, and there are many people who are avowed racists. I don't think that's something that needs to be personalized in the way that the media have done. But at any rate, in this New York Times article, they had to backtrack. They changed the article title. People were writing in. And I thought about a couple of things. The fact that they did this article at all, but also some of the frankly phony outrage that came from New York Times readers and other people who would be aghast if you told them they were racist or that they benefit from white supremacy when they do every day. So I raised the issue, for example, here in New York, all these New Yorkers writing to the New York Times and clutching their pearls about coverage of a white nationalist. Right. When we had, when it was at its height, at its worst, stop and frisk, when Bloomberg was mayor of New York City, and black people in particular were being stopped and harassed by the police. And there were actually arrest quotas in New York. I mean, most places there's a quota for writing parking tickets or something, but there was extreme pressure on the police to make arrests. And who do you think that impacted? Yeah. But every indication, white New Yorkers thought that was just fine. Every poll showed that most white people thought that was fine.
You know, not and for that, nothing. The New York Times, by the way, was referring to like black teenagers as wolf packs and all kinds. You know, this whole they were animalizing black people in the New York Times in the very pages that they're complaining about this now.
Absolutely, they were. And but if you asked someone, if you confronted someone who thought that those policies were fine, and said, well, that makes you a white supremacist, they would, most of them, I think, would have argued against it. So my first point was that, you know, people can't, we can't let Trump let racism get out of jail free card, right, as I say, where if you're not a Nazi, if you're not a white supremacist, you are allowed to live your life without being confronted about the variety of ways in which, as a white person, one has a variety of advantages. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I could go on. You know, people who would not, didn't complain about stop and frisk, people who say nothing about mass incarceration, they either don't care or they think it's a good idea for as many black people as possible to be locked away. People who gentrify. My neighborhood here in Harlem, I've lived here for about 30 years, and I'd say for 20 of those years, there were hardly any white people. Now, every new person who moves in is white, and that's creating displacement.
Right.
And that is racism. That is white supremacy.
Yep.
So, but it's never called that. And so that's an easy out. It's like shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah, and very
to
few
point fingers at a guy who has Nazi memorabilia.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's supposed to, in other words, this normal racism that exists in the country, in other words, the normalized racism that exists, is sort of not covered. Here is an example of not normalized racism, and that personifies all racism. So see those 12 guys over there? They're the racists. The rest of you folks over here, you're fine.
Yeah, yeah, you're good. You know, and you didn't vote for Trump,
right?
And you voted for Hillary, and so you're okay. Well, I'm saying no, you're not.
Yeah,
necessarily.
I mean, you mentioned mass incarceration, for example, and then you mentioned Hillary. That's one of the first things that popped in my head. Of course, when we go back to Bill Clinton's administration and the various federal bills that both increased the federal prison population and modeled for the state increases that followed.
Yes, and she, of course, supported it and referred to black teens as, was it super predators?
Super predators,
who have to
yeah.
be brought to heel like
yeah.
like dogs.
Yep, right.
And speaking of animalizing human
yeah, right.
beings.
Yeah, exactly, yep.
So, so she was in the forefront of something which decimated the black community and is still decimating us in a variety of ways. And yet, because of this political system we have, this duopoly, which does not allow for any other voices to be heard, we have these two parties, which are allegedly polar opposites, but not really. And most black people cling to the Democratic Party to try to fight against the Republican Party, which for the last 50 years or so has been the white people's party. So we desperately cling to this party in order to fight the one that is worse in some ways.
Right.
But in fact, it's just like a kabuki theater of who's who's really worse.
Right.
But because it doesn't matter who's in the White House, the prison population doesn't go down.
Right.
It doesn't matter who's in the White House. Police still have the right to kill with impunity.
Right.
So there's arguing around the margins of what is considered acceptable discourse in this country.
Right.
So so here we are giving our votes to these people who don't do any more for us, and in fact can be more harmful because they have the cover of being Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, this goes really to the heart of the question of identity politics versus revolutionary politics. So form versus essence, symbology as opposed to, you know, the material. You have the New York Times propping up symbols of racism, and so people don't see the actual racism, which is, in, you know, in, right in front of them in their daily lives. But nobody, that's not part of the public discourse. You have, you know, a variety of different, look at the one of the primary examples of the expression of white supremacy that's taken place in the last 50 years, maybe, the recolonization of Africa.
Yes.
But that takes place at the hands of a black president, so it's not racist. It's not white supremacy. It's something else. I mean, in other words, the symbology blurs the material. And then, so you have, you know, on the one hand, real racists hiding behind some knucklehead, you know, with a Nazi uniform in Ohio.
Right.
And you have real white supremacist, you know, imperial foreign policy hiding behind a black president.
Well, if you, yes, and then another excellent example is Libya.
Right.
Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton destroyed Libya.
Right.
And empowered these, now Libya, there is no Libyan state as such anymore. There are several factions, rival factions, fighting over that territory. And now we see the literal enslavement of migrants from other African countries.
Yeah, after the lynchings that were at the beginning that were incited essentially by the CIA, which was operating under Obama.
It all happened under Obama. All black towns, such as a city called Tuerga, were literally reduced to rubble.
Incinerated.
Yes, they were. Dark-skinned Libyans and African migrants were targeted for mass murder. And all of this happened because of Obama and Clinton.
Right.
Now it's in the news again because there is some footage of these slave auctions actually taking place. There are stories of people having their organs harvested. And that has something to do, organ trafficking. Israel is the number one country involved in that. That's been documented many times. But now everyone's in an uproar. But nobody wants to mention Obama and Clinton and their role in making this happen. Yes, NATO was involved, but the rest of NATO doesn't act unless the United States gives the go-ahead.
That's right.
And Hillary Clinton and the then UK Prime Minister Cameron and who was France at the time, Sarkozy, all showed up personally in Libya to dance on Gaddafi's grave, so to speak, and to brag about having committed this war crime. That's all it can be called.
Well, Sarkozy,
so now people want to talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, Sarkozy, you know, did a little advance dance over in Cote d'Ivoire, by the way, when he sent the French troops in to pull Gbagbo out of the presidential palace at gunpoint. And the U.S. sent them there because the first onslaught into Libya was reported in the Pakistan Observer in February of 2011, U.S., U.K., and French troops landed in East Europe on troop transport.
Yes.
Joint project.
But now that this story of enslavement is in the news, many reporters won't even mention Obama and Clinton by name.
I know.
I'm like, and I have called people to task. I have gone on Twitter. I have emailed people, and I have asked them, how do you write about the destruction of Libya and not mention the names Obama and Clinton?
Right.
And then some people are like, can we blame them? You know, there is, but it's still like very, very weak. and talk about excuse me, color supremacy. My God, but that is something they are directly responsible for having carried out. And the New York Times never, ever covered this, ever.
Nope.
At any rate, so that's another example of the blatant white supremacy, that this happened because of the black president of the United States gave the go-ahead. It would not have happened absent Barack Obama. And people, now he's trying to say he made a mistake in Libya because he didn't plan for the aftermath. And I'm sick and tired of these aggressions. Yeah, these aggressions being called mistakes. Iraq was a mistake. Libya was a mistake. Interventions are war crimes.
Yeah.
And American liberals need to stop. They need to call, they are war crimes. They need to be referred to as such. And they're, of course, they're always covered with, in Libya, it was supposed to be a humanitarian intervention. Mm. So they made up lies with the help of Human Rights Watch and the International Criminal Court, the ICC, saying that Gaddafi's troops had been given Viagra and they were all going to go on a raping spree. And these are the kinds of things that were lies that were used to justify the destruction of this country. Mm-hmm. So, and that's also a kind of white supremacy, the worst kind, actually, where people, a nation was destroyed, people have been killed, people are being killed, people are suffering now because of this country, because of a democratic president who's now being held up as some paragon of virtue because he has better manners than Donald Trump does.
Mm. Yeah, there's really low-hanging fruit, too.
Yes, it is.
You know, you've got not just the, you know, the excuse that it was a mistake. In the case of Libya, all right, we had heard in the case of Iraq about the list of the countries that we got from Clinton's old Joint Chiefs of Staff head. I can't remember the general's name at the moment, but there was the list of Iraq, Iran, you know, yada yada yada, that were all, you know, being targeted for regime change, and so we could see the pattern there. Those of us that were, you know, paying any attention, but what list we haven't seen is the one where Libya is the gateway to Africa, because you had the French go into Cote d'Ivoire, and about 2 seconds after the U.S. started taking down Libya, they went into Mali and a bunch of other countries that were formerly, quote-unquote, French Africa. And you had, in the background, through the Bush administration, they were, you know, rumbling that they needed to revive SOUTHCOM and create AFRICOM. And then they actually established AFRICOM legally in October of 2008. In other words, while they were supposed to be busy trying to save the economy because it had tanked and they were, you know, giving the banks trillions of dollars and, you know, all of that, they open up in Stuttgart, Germany, the offices of the African Command of the U.S. military, because no country on the African continent would host them, even though there's all this money that goes with it. You know, even though there's all kinds of economic benefits, you know, for the moment of, you know, you have here a few thousand people that are going to be buying steaks and cars and whatever from local, you know, folks. Despite all of that, everybody said, hell no. And the main impediment to the U.S. reentering was Libya, who had had the last U.S. military troops in 1969, right after the revolution in 69. Libya, Gaddafi evicted them, and that was the last U.S. troops on the African continent with a permanent base. So after they take down Libya, suddenly AFRICOM is installed in 35 African countries and is operating now as, in essence, the command and control for almost all of the militaries on the African continent. What a mistake. They just slipped into, oops, what a boo-boo.
Yes, yes. And so, but they're allowed to get away with these lies because there is not an understanding of, or I guess an acknowledgement of U.S. imperialism. And because we have these and I was just thinking of the word, is a very juvenile understanding of politics in this country, where one side of the duopoly is bad, 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 evil. The other side, we have to rejoice if they're in power. But in fact, it's like a tag team. It's like professional wrestling. I mean, many, many people have said that. It's like there's a phony villain and a phony hero, but the whole thing is phony. And so one side gets to be presented as being evil and horrible. The other side gets to be presented as being good. There's no alternative. Anybody who dares suggest that we seek out an alternative is called a supporter of the evil, bad people. And so it goes on and on and on, where so now you have a one some, you know, cracker in Ohio being profiled in the New York Times. And yes, it's a puff piece, and, and no, it should not have been. But he gets to stand for all racism in the country as it is practiced. And other people get to pat themselves on the back, people who support horrible things otherwise, some because they're not aware. And I always have to remind myself how the role the media play in just in not telling people things. It's interesting to me. ISIS is out of Syria, for example. Have you seen that in the New York Times?
Yeah, not at all. Nope.
ISIS was supposed to be evil, but it, of course, ISIS was doing America's work for it in attacking the secular Arab regimes. And Putin helped Assad to get ISIS out of Syria. So now you can't, they won't tell you that ISIS has been defeated in Syria. ISIS has been defeated in Iraq. And so that goes unmentioned. So I think about, I'm digressing a little bit, but all of the things that are just kept from us, the lies of omission that are just inconvenient. So they are not allowed in the pages of the newspaper. And so people get to have these views about goodness and badness and racism and not racism that are based on lies or on trivialities.
Like artificial parameters. I mean, for example, I don't know how many people this character represents out in Ohio, he gets profiled and is the center of controversy, and we're even speaking about him now just because it's a thing, you know? However, not Glenn Ford, Bruce Dixon, Margaret Kimberly, Danny Haifong, Ajamu Baraka, mentioned, except for Ajamu, because he actually ran for vice president. Maybe they mentioned him twice. New York Times never mentioned. I'm looking at blackagendaradio.podbean.com, where the Black Agenda Radio program is hosted. It's a server that radio stations use to download it. 1.794 million downloads. Okay? How many downloads do you think Homeboy out in Ohio has on his little blog page? What, 50, 100, 250, 1,000? And he gets profiled, Black Agenda who? At the New York Times.
Well, that, you know, and that was my other, and I'm one of the people who wrote to the Times, and I said, can you ever find a leftist to profile? And I added, I said, and I didn't say Democrat, I said leftist.
That's right, big difference.
They use these people to gin up hysteria, to help their readers feel superior. And I have not even of the Green Party. I've never seen a profile of a Green Party voter or candidate in the New York Times. Maybe I missed it. I mean, it could have been in there. But that would give legitimacy to people being opposed to the system. That would give legitimacy to people questioning the manufactured consent. So that is something that's forbidden. But they'll reach out to this guy and cause a big drama that's also phony.
Well, let's go back to Crossfire on CNN, for example, which was the debate program that they had. It still is, I guess. I think they still use it. The left, quote unquote, you had Tom Brady. And on the right, you had, I forgot his name, that was in the Nixon administration. He's a kind of a wild man, right winger. But Tom Brady.
Buchanan.
Yeah, Pat Buchanan, right. And actually, he doesn't get much airtime anymore because he's actually sort of an oppositionist, you know, more than sort of. He's an oppositionist. He's outside the framework of, you know, official opposition now. But Tom Brayton, the leftist, was a CIA official.
Yes.
And his biggest legacy was that he wrote Eight is Enough, the book. He's the author of that. While he was in the CIA, he wrote about his family life, and Eight is Enough came out of that. He represented the left throughout the 80s. Yes. When Reagan was threatening World War III, he was representing us.
Yes, we were told. Yes, exactly. And that's what we get. And people who really are on the left have to be disappeared. And now, of course, they are using Russiagate as an excuse to further disappear. Right. The internet leveled the playing field a little bit, and that we all had the ability to seek out new sources of information.
Yep.
So now, under the guise of fighting Vladimir Putin, they've changed the algorithms on Google. So, and I've seen this myself, try to search for articles by name that I wrote in Black Agenda.
Yeah, right. You can't find your own stuff in Google.
It's disappeared. And they admitted that they're doing this. And this is supposed to be to fight the foreign interference from the evil Russians.
Right.
And this is being used to make certain that we don't have a voice at all, that the one vehicle we have been able to use to change discourse, to give new information, to make sure that is disappeared altogether. They're trying to disappear RT and Sputnik altogether. They had to register as foreign agents. They took Congress took RT's press. It's not a pass. I'm sorry. I'm blanking on the term. Credentials. I'm still blanking on the term. But at any rate, so they have been silenced too.
Yep. And let alone lesser quote unquote voices. I don't know the last time I saw Telesur, for example, mentioned at all. And frankly, I don't think they're all that radical, with the exception of their coverage of Venezuela. And yet it's, you know, head and shoulders outside of the, you know, parameters of what the New York Times will cover. Go to the New York Times, you know, world page for the Americas. You would think once in a while this Latin America-based English language media source would be a source of a report once a year. And I've never seen it. So, you know, the complete universe, Press TV. When they report on Iran, I mean, we've been dealing with Iran in the media since at least, if not 1953, 1979. I don't think I've seen the New York Times refer to Press TV once, except when they were beaten up on them for something, I forget, 5-6 years ago that happened, one occasion. That was it. Instead of normally, this is what they say in Tehran on Press TV, this is what they say in Saudi Arabia on Al Arabiya. You know, they don't do that at all.
No, they don't. And when Trump announced a couple of days ago that he would recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, you would think that some Palestinians would be interviewed.
Right.
And of course, that's not what happened. Ali Abunima from Electronic Intifada said he was interviewed by Russia television, and he was on TV in the UK and some other place. No calls from any American corporate media. So they were, the Palestinians were disappeared, as if that this discussion has nothing to do with them.
Their defender, quote unquote, who really was only defending them to the extent he could attack Trump, was Wolf Blitzer, who worked for AIPAC and was a reporter for the Jerusalem Post. That was the coverage from the Palestinian side on CNN.
He was representing Palestine.
Yep.
But those are things that Americans, it's frightening to me, the degree to which this media that's so all pervasive, that it lies to people and spins a whole tale with, you know, sometimes we have to choose a date, Don, to talk about Russiagate.
Yeah.
And the various ways in which it's used to excuse the Democrats' defeat to Trump, to make the case literally for war.
Yeah.
So it is a tremendous, tremendous lie. And they do it. It's very simple, really. They do it by repetition. You just repeat the same things over and over and over again and make sure that a counter argument is never allowed to see the light of day.
That's right.
And you can convince people that and everything bad happening in the world is Vladimir Putin's fault. And the United States has never done anything bad anywhere in the world. That should be a topic for another day.
I mean, all you need to do is interview anybody anywhere else in the world, and they'll give you the lowdown on that. But, you know, all right, you close it with, the open white supremacist cannot be the determining factor of how we pursue political action. Amen to that. And then that the same is true of faux outrage from the white liberals, which cannot be trusted either.
No, it cannot. But it just shows you the precarious nature and the failure of black politics, the fact that we don't have black politics anymore, that we allow these trivial matters. I'm not saying racism is trivial, but people being worked up over coverage of a racist guy in Ohio, to allow that to be the determining factor of how we organize. Or frankly, not talking about asking the question of how we organize and how we practice self-determination, so that we're not fooled anymore, we're not jerked around by phony issues, and that we give ourselves permission to critique people who think they're on our side or pretend to be on our side because they can't stomach the fact that some Trump supporter in Nowheresville was given a profile in the New York Times.
Margaret Kimberly has a weekly column at blackagendareport.com under the banner Freedom Rider. We've been talking about her article last week entitled Contradictions of White Supremacy, and thank you very much. We definitely need to speak some more about some of the things you mentioned. Barnett, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. Donald Trump's decision to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem signals Washington now deems this to be Israel's capital. Reaction was easy to predict, various degrees of dismay. How this is in America's interest is difficult to fathom. The law of unintended consequences is surely in play. Crosstalking Jerusalem, I'm joined by my guest, Philip Giraldi in Percival. He is a former CIA counterterrorism specialist who is now executive director of the Council for the National Interest. In Washington, we have Grant Smith. He is the director of the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy, as well as author of Big Israel, How Israel's Lobby Moves America. And in Philadelphia, we cross to Greg Roman. He is the chief operations officer for the Middle East Forum. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Philip, let me go to you first here. Donald Trump ran on the platform of making America great again. How is it recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, advancing that agenda, making America great again? And I would add, you know, making American foreign policy great again. I don't know. Go ahead, Philip.
Yeah, well, that's the fundamental question here. I mean, basically, people like myself, people who consider themselves patriotic Americans are wondering when Donald Trump is going to start delivering on changing our foreign policy, which has been destructive of the United States. In this particular case, you have to ask, what does the United States and what do Americans get out of this? They don't get anything out of this. Essentially, this is going to create a lot of problems. Having been a diplomat overseas myself, I can tell you that the security is going to have to go through the roof at embassies and military installations around the world. American tourists are going to be potential targets of terrorism, much more so than they are now. American businessmen are going to have to consider the security costs of setting up a business overseas. So there's going to be a whole lot of downside to this decision. It's not just a simple decision about where somebody puts an embassy. This has a lot of consequences to it. And if you read the media that's coming out after this story, explaining how it came to be, you'll find that there was a lot of push backwards from people in the administration who didn't want to do this, but Trump insisted he would do it.
Okay. Greg, and same question, I mean, and maybe I'll advance it even further. How is it in America's interest, and how is it in Israel's interest? Both countries, same question. Go ahead, Greg, in Philadelphia.
So on the American side, we see that effectively we've been recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital since 1949. American presidents, secretaries of state, and other diplomats often visit there. Israel's parliament's there, the prime minister's office, the president's office, and the Supreme Court. So after 30 years of peace processing from when George Shultz announced that the PLO was the representative of the Palestinian people back in 88, until today, we've seen a process where America has taken the position of a neutral arbiter between the Palestinians and the Israelis. It hasn't gotten us anywhere. In fact, insofar as the Palestinians have been able to get concession after concession from the Israelis, they've responded with violence. So I think what Trump is doing is he's flipping the peace paradigm on its head. Instead of making Israel make concessions, he's saying to the Palestinians, the future of American foreign policy will move forward with or without you, and it's time for you to get to the peace table and to negotiate on our terms.
Okay. Well, then, number one, I guess you're assuming, let me go to Grant here, that I agree. The facade that America is a neutral arbiter is finally, the mask is finally off, because it's been a charade for decades, okay? I guess that is a good thing here. I certainly don't know what concessions the Palestinians can make at this point. They almost have nothing left here. Grant, let me go to you. I mean, the United States has been often called Israel's lawyer. Now it looks like it's Israel's real estate agent. Go ahead, Grant.
This is the biggest disaster since 1973, when Golda Meir convinced Richard Nixon not to advance the nuclear nonproliferation treaty when Israel started building and trying to sell to apartheid South Africa nuclear weapons 5 years later. It's an unmitigated disaster. It's making the U.S. be dragged out of UN Security Council Resolution 478. By just saying we're no longer going to pressure Israel to recognize the fact that it illegally seized East Jerusalem and then tried in the 1980s to claim it was all theirs. You know, if this is the art of the deal, Donald Trump wrote back in the day, his first chapter must have said something like, make all your concessions before negotiations start. So what we're going to see forthrightly is that the Israelis are going to say, well, now you have to realize and recognize that all of Jerusalem is Israel's. And then they're going to say, now you've got to recognize all of the illegal settlements are Israel's. And they're going to keep pushing and pushing. And the U.S., unless it can free itself of the Israel lobby's hold over the political campaign contribution process, is just going to reel from disaster to disaster and undermine its own national security and credibility.
You know, Philip, I'm glad that Graham brought that up, because, you know, of course, I look at the mainstream media covering this story the last 36 hours, and, you know, I don't hear mention of Resolution 478 and 181. They're very germane to this thing here. The United States, by recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, is in violation of international law. It's very, very simple language. You can look it up. It's easy. Go ahead, Philip.
Yeah, this is one of the interesting aspects of it. The fact is, the United States technically is still supports those resolutions, but the fact is, the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital confuses a lot of different issues in terms of what is the legal status of Jerusalem, for example. That pretty much is still defined by the 1947 by the UN,
right,
when the state of Israel was created. It defined what would be the situation in Jerusalem as an international city under UN auspices that would be open to everyone. But that, of course, went out the window when the war or the fighting started between the Israelis and the Palestinians. So basically, we have a situation where the legal issues are very clear and on one hand, but in practice, very confusing. So it's something that this is a mess that Trump did not have to step into.
Yeah.
And it will only have bad consequences. And yet he did it. And yet he did it knowing full well from some of his advisors like Tillerson
and Mattis
that essentially this is a very, very bad idea.
You know, Greg, weigh in on the international law aspect of it. I mean, I mentioned the two resolutions, 478 and 181. I mean, from your understanding, are they still in force? Because everybody else in the world seems to think they are. Go ahead.
Well, I would point you to first that back in 1947 and then in May of 48, Israel accepted that UN resolution. And if it wasn't for the invasion of seven Arab armies into Jerusalem proper, the illegal occupation of Jerusalem
by Jordan
from 48
until 67. Yeah, but that doesn't null the resolution. But it doesn't null the resolution.
I'm not saying it nulls the resolution, but if we want to talk about the status quo ante and the actual facts of what's on the ground right now, we have to look at also UN Resolution 242. Which says that there will be a negotiation for what they consider to be disputed territories after UN Resolution 181.
Where's the negotiation?
So if you want to look at what is the customary international humanitarian law on this, or if we... Hold on a second. There was plenty of negotiations from the Oslo process all the way through the end of the Obama administration.
But not on
Israel
Jerusalem.
Israel was willing to give up 100% of the land with land swaps on Jerusalem, too. Shuafat, Ras Al Din, Ramallah, Abu Dhabi.
That would be part of the final settlement. We all know that. It would be part of the final settlement. Trump is trying to do everything backwards, okay? And, Greg, I'll give you one point. What we've seen over the last 30 years has failed. I think that's true, okay? Okay, but I would say it was designed to fail here. Let me go to Grant here. I mean, you know, my problem with this is if the U.S. is going to recognize Jerusalem as part of some plan that Jared Kushner is working on that nobody knows anything about, okay, then what could possibly be the plan if you negotiate the status of Jerusalem first instead of last? What has he got up his sleeve, if anything? I don't believe it. Go ahead, Grant.
There's no plan. It's every time the U.S. sends a predominantly Zionist team to so-called negotiate anything, they come back and they say, well, you know, we didn't get anywhere. And the problem with the entire sword of Damocles that has been hanging over U.S. presidents in the 1995 Jerusalem Embassy Act, you know who wrote that act? The Zionist Organization of America and AIPAC. And why did they write that act, forcing the U.S. State Department, coercing the State Department not to receive any funding for overseas installations until they built an embassy in Jerusalem? It's because Israel and its lobby wanted to preempt the Oslo peace process, and they wanted to preempt any possibility that there would be a negotiation over the Palestinian right to share Jerusalem, borders, any sort of issues that were on the table. They wanted to preempt it by making U.S. presidents squirm under this ridiculous act. And fortunately, until recently, no president, although the campaign and promised the Israel lobby that they'd move the embassy, no president was actually willing to take the dangerous step of actually doing it. So, you know, it's an unmitigated disaster.
Okay, let me go to Philip before we go to the break here. Philip, real quick before we go to the break here. Do you have much confidence in Jared Kushner as being a grand diplomat, a metronik or something like that? Go ahead.
No, I have no confidence whatsoever. I mean, he has no experience whatsoever. He's noted for his Zionist ties. His family helped pay for settlement activity that's illegal on the West Bank. This is a guy who's an Israel firster, as the expression goes, and he's surrounded by Israel firsters, the U.S. Ambassador David Friedman and Greenblatt, and these people are all out for Israel. And as I keep saying, I'm an American. Donald Trump is an American president. When is he going to represent American interests and protect the American people? By doing foolish things like this, all he's going to do is be costing us money and giving us pain.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Jerusalem. Stay with RT. Okay. Okay, Greg, one of the first things, the reactions to Trump's announcement is that the alienation of the Arab world, you know, all the way from Saudi Arabia to Jordan to Turkey, Egypt. But I think there's a more of a caveat here, and I'll be quite cynical because politics is at its very heart cynical. I get the impression that the Saudis probably aren't so angry with this after all. You know, they don't care about the Palestinians. Let's face it, most Arab countries don't care about the Palestinians. They, you know, they use the issue when they want to. They can turn up the volume and turn it down. But, you know, over the last 30 years, the Arabs haven't done much for the Palestinians. And so, you know, if there's any kind of grand bargain going on, it's between Kushner and the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia, which I, given those two characters, I would be a bit worried here. But I think there's a kernel of truth in what I had to say there. Greg, go ahead.
I couldn't agree with you more. The Palestinians are on the last thought of every Arab leader. They're more worried about their own countries. And the biggest threat in the region is Iran. So with Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan all coordinating with Israel now facing the specter of Iranian dominance from Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Tehran, I think that this is a bold move on Trump right now to make the Palestinians realize that they're boxed into a corner. I mean, historically, wars end when one side loses. And until the Palestinians realize that they have lost this struggle for trying to gain a state from the river to the sea, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, they'll keep on being isolated. So it's the Palestinians who have the onus of coming to the table. And Trump recognized that with this move,
on,
by flipping
Greg,
the peace paradigm on its head.
Everybody abandons them. Everybody abandons them, and it's their fault here. Now, I think that's disingenuous here. Philip, I saw you really grimacing there. You know, Iran. I guess it's all about Iran. It's always about Iran. I mean, this is amazing. Your reaction, Philip, it's about Iran. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, this could be written by the Israeli foreign ministry, that Iran is always the enemy. It's, I was watching the movie 1984 last night. You remember how there were permanent enemies and permanent friends who would shift every once in a while. It's the same thing. I mean, the Israelis need an enemy to justify the horrific treatment they have meted out to the Palestinians, and they justify it through this Iranian enemy. The Iranians have not invaded or attacked anybody in 300 years. The Israelis make a regular practice of attacking their neighbors. So who's the aggressive state?
That's a very good point. You know, Grant, a lot of people will say...
I don't think that could be farther from the truth.
Okay, well, that's a historical fact. Okay, Grant, let me go to you in Washington here. I mean, again, given Trump's lack of interest and knowledge of foreign affairs, which is, I think, quite transparent, okay, obviously, this is all about domestic politics. I mean, this is a bid on his part for the GOP to be the more firster of the firsters for Israel. And it might be working, okay? And, of course, he's playing the evangelical card here. I mean, it's more about domestic politics here, in my mind, particularly when it comes to Trump. And we all know, however you feel about U.S.-Israeli policy, you know, Trump is surrounded by people that are very, very pro-Israel and profoundly anti-Iran. Go ahead, Grant.
Yeah, well, let me put some facts on the table. According to a poll my organization did, 56% of Americans were opposed to moving the embassy to Jerusalem. Brookings just put out a poll saying that while 50% of Republicans supported it, 70% of Democrats were vehemently against it. And they know it because it is a destabilizing move that could have, again, disastrous consequences for the U.S. Now, Iran is not the bogeyman that the Israel lobby says it is. But they have, they're on track to be a $6 billion industry in the United States by 2020. They have vast resources to spread, like they did before the Iraq War, all of these concepts of weapons of mass destruction and threats to America, which ultimately proved false. They'd love Americans to focus entirely on Iran, which is not a threat to the United States, and ignore this most destabilizing issue, which provided motivation for the 9/11 hijackers. You know, you can almost see the glee in the Israel lobby pundits on the media in the U.S. just saying, check out the Arab street. It's broiling. It's going to burst into violence. And we're going, you know, poor Israel. We're going to have to face this backlash, just like Netanyahu said after 9/11. Well, this will be good for Israel because the U.S. will see what we're up against. Well, no. We have to take a step back, look at the bigger picture, and see what that's driving all of this. It's not the U.S. interest. The United States is not in the driver's seat. It's this lobby that has erected such a hold over Congress and the political process to the point where politicians cannot even launch a campaign without tapping it and providing a position paper, giving away and supporting all of AIPAC's positions. So it's a disastrous blow to U.S. sovereignty and national security to continue letting Israel make U.S. foreign policy as Americans essentially, you know, go along and go with the flow for the money, the support, the vast amount of think tanks and other pundits who are saying this is such a brilliant move. It's very obviously not, and Americans are opposed to it. Yeah. You ask them in a legitimate poll, is this a good move? They say, no, don't do it.
Well, I mean, I think all of us know that the foreign policy elites don't care about public opinion, and I don't know the last time when they did. Greg, let me ask you, what does the United States get out of its relationship with Israel? I mean, arms sales? I mean, what do they get out of it? Because as someone once said to me, I will let you answer, as someone said to me once, you know, before Israel, the United States didn't have any enemies in the Middle East. Afterwards, it has no friends, okay? Go ahead, Greg.
If you look at the first war that America fought, it was with the Middle East versus the Barbary pirates in the early 1800s. So that's just a false statement coming out of the barrel. It was 150 years before Israel existed.
There's a lot of anti-Americanism in the Middle East. And I think, as Philip has pointed out, with this move, it'll even get worse. That is my point. So I'll ask my question again. What does the United States get out of its relationship with Israel? Go ahead.
So to look at the asset test between what the U.S.-Israel relationship has, I think that the joining of not just economic and trade benefits which are associated with it, but the fact that you have the only democracy in the Middle East aligning with the only democracy that's really at a bright spot right now in the West, you find that they're able to go forward.
Ridiculous.
If you want to be able to have between having someone who... Hold on a second.
The U.S. trade relation with Israel
with a guy
is
who,
completely bogus.
Hold on. Wait one second. I had my chance to answer. You have your chance to answer,
Israeli
too.
Israeli espionage and AIPAC.
So wait one second. You have a guy who's peddling a conspiracy.
$160 billion
Come on, I'm trying to give an answer, guys.
I know we're hearing the usual
Respond to the question, Greg.
I know we're hearing the usual talking points, but it is my obligation. It's my program, and it's my obligation to give my guest his say, even if I vehemently disagree with him. Greg, please, in Philadelphia.
Thank you, Peter. It's always a pleasure being with you. So on one side, you have a group which is saying that there's no benefit to the relationship, who's peddling conspiracy theories. On the other, you have those who cavort with Holocaust deniers. And I think you have to look in the middle, which is the fact that there is a U.S.-Israel relationship that provides defense benefits, it provides religious benefits, it provides over 3 million Israelis that came to the United States for tourist activities. And on the other side as well, the actual trade relationships and the technology that American companies get out of it is indicated by what's on the ground. Microsoft, Freescale Semiconductor, Facebook, Wave. All great companies that originated in America and are active in Israel
right now.
So that's just on the bilateral side. On the regional side, they get intelligence cooperation.
Greg, all of that could happen without the same kind of strategic relationship. I don't see how they're exactly tied together, okay? Okay, Philip, I saw you again grimacing. Go ahead.
Well, as soon as I hear Holocaust deniers, I know what kind of game is being played here. I mean, this is the constant vilification of anybody who criticizes Israel in any way. And I think what you have to look at in terms of this latest move about Jerusalem, who's delighted by it? Bibi Netanyahu, war criminal. The settlers, fascists. The Christian Zionists, basically, who want Armageddon to come so that the world will end, so they can be raptured up to heaven. And, of course, there are the mega billionaires, all of whom are Jewish, who support this activity and have supported the Trump administration in doing this and have been pushing for it. So, you know, we have a delightful group of people, basically, that are demanding this move of the or this move on the embassy. And the rest of us who criticize it, I guess, are just Holocaust deniers.
Grant, Jeff.
The interesting thing that Greg raised about the trade relationship is the fact that in 1985, Dan Halpern of the Israeli Ministry of Economics and AIPAC stole American industry trade secrets to pass that deal. And it's the worst bilateral trade deal in terms of cumulative deficit of all bilateral trade deals. It had to be accomplished through espionage and thwarting the will of American industry labor and trade groups because it was a bad deal. And you can clearly see that. Now, Dan, you know, Greg can defend that as being a wonderful thing, but it was another plot hatched by AIPAC and its many supporters in the Israel lobby across the U.S. to take something from America, an additional $10 billion in aid by pushing through a group of concessions that allow Israeli exports free access to the U.S. market while U.S. exporters are essentially locked out. You know, and Israel continues to spy on the United States, divert nuclear weapons technology and know-how. It's absolutely ridiculous to say that this is a security relationship when you have so much espionage going on the part of the Israelis.
Because I want to have crosstalk rules, I'm going to give Greg the last word here with the following question. Greg, wouldn't it be just better to settle with the Palestinians and get this in the past, because it looks like Israel wants to keep this conflict, what people call apartheid, together? Wouldn't it be better just to make a deal and move on? Go ahead.
Peter, I couldn't agree with you more. But the thing is that when the Palestinians and the Israelis come to the table, if it was under Obama, Bush, Clinton, Reagan, the other Bush, every single time that the Israelis are willing to make a deal, the Palestinians reject it. So I think going back to an earlier conversation today, you're taking the art of the deal from Donald Trump, and sometimes you have to flip the conference table over and see where the pieces land. I think there will be eventually a state of Palestine with a capital in East Jerusalem, but it has to be on the U.S.-Israel rules, with the Palestinians coming to the table to recognize those actual circumstances.
Okay, I have to jump in here, gentlemen. I'm going to end on the following phrase. Sure. The law of unintended consequences. Buckle up. Impact. Soon. Many thanks to my guests in Percival, Washington, and in Philadelphia. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.